Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and this is Analyst Talk with Jason Elder, the special edition limited series called Sean Baer's Guide to Hiring Law Enforcement Analysts.
This is our final step.
We've made our way all the way through the hiring process thus far. We're at the end of the journey. We're at the exit. And so there's obviously many different ways to leave a position. Talk a little bit about firing, laying off, resignations. Let's start from the manager's point of view. Let's talk about maybe some best practices or lessons learned from firing or laying off.
Woof. This isn't going to end my day well. Talking about this. It was the worst, absolute worst part, even worse than paying taxes at the rate we were paying. It was the worst thing that I ever had to do as an employer. And I have been fired from jobs, I'll say that. So I've also been on the receiving end of it too. So not the best of circumstances, let's put it that way. The best way to do it is quickly and with no emotion, frankly, with just sort of matter of fact, here are the reasons, and thank you and best wishes to you. The manager should always have at least two people in the room when this is happening. These are all guidelines that have been provided to me by lawyers throughout the years, human resource experts, as well as through business school. You learn these techniques. Obviously, the reason why we have two people there is to make sure that we can document what was said and what was not said. I've never gone so far as to, I don't think, record. Nothing was ever at that sort of heightened level. We may have recorded, now that I think about it, the termination for theft. That was sort of big. But it's important to have two people there, and it's important to consult with usually legal counsel before you do it. It's becoming a litigious world. So before I ever terminated anybody's employment, whether it be through just laying off or because there was some reason why I felt they needed to be terminated, I always talk to the attorney first. And I never, ever, nor will I in the future either, make a rash decision to terminate somebody's employment. Because there's nothing more traumatic for the employee in their employment than having that happen. So I always at least slept on it at night. And I always made sure I consulted with the attorney to make sure that I was, one, in the right, that I was terminating for rightful reasons, and that I had covered the company's bases so that nothing could be, you know, come back. So those are some bits of advice for managers there. The resignation's easy. Somebody ever submitted a resignation, and many people have to me. I always wish them well. I always tell them that I'd like to keep in touch. And if they ever need anything from me, any letters of recommendation, any, you know, referrals, or if I could do anything for them, I was always willing to do that. And I meant it. The resignation is usually, frankly, a happy situation. It's kind of sad in that they're resigning from the company. Hopefully they're not resigning because they didn't like the company or like the employer. Usually they resigned because they had bigger opportunities. I was always grateful for that. Whether it be Zuhu or whether it be Baer Analytics or even Baer Software way, way back in the day, I was grateful that we could give them an opportunity to build their acumen to, in fact, leverage us to get a better job. I never had ill will toward that. We can always get another employee. If this was what's best for them and right for them, then I wanted them to accept that and again, wish them well. Good for them. So that's a good thing. Termination, not so fun. I usually had big struggles with that. I'm not alone with that. Every other owner or manager or CEO or person in authority position who had to let somebody go once, I don't know anybody that I've met that has had that be an enjoyable experience. They've usually either lost sleep or, you know, really struggled with it. And frankly, struggle with it quite a time after the event itself. So now that's not to say, woe is me or woe is, you know, feel so bad for the managers. The employee had it worse because they lost their job, but it's never a good thing from both perspectives. But what needs to happen is it needs to happen quickly, not only for that employee's sake to be able to get on with their career, better for both parties, because I've often found that the employee oftentimes knows they're probably going to get fired. That's been my experience, either because they know they have poor performance, they know they did something wrong, or there's a reason for it. Usually they're not blindsided. There's probably some sense that, you know what, I'm probably going to get fired. So the worst thing that could happen is that the manager keeps sort of prolonging it and making it even more painful for the employee. and themselves in dragging it out. Just get it over with, band-aid right off, and everybody learns lessons from it.
Yeah, it's usually the layoffs that I think catch people off guard.
Those do.
Yeah. I wanted to just add, a friend of mine works for the state of Florida, and he recently had to fire somebody. Mm-hmm. And so he's working with HR, and they're giving him the do's and don'ts. One of the don'ts was don't apologize.
Absolutely. Right.
And because so
you want to apologize.
Yes. And that's probably more for the job seeker listening to that, or the employee listening to that, that understand managers are going to be advised to say or not to say certain stuff.
Truthfully, so, they're going to be robotic.
Yes.
Because they can't say they're sorry, because boom, I've just put myself in a defensive position legally. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, okay, what are you sorry about? You made a mistake on something? That's why you're terminating me, because you made a mistake? So that, yeah, you avoid those words oftentimes to protect the company from any sort of recourse. And also, you got to be careful because of how it works with unemployment and everything else too.
There's a lot to that.
There's a lot to it.
So at this stage for the manager, we've now gone through the whole hiring process, basically. So it's at this point in time that as a manager, you can look back and evaluate whether the hire was successful or a failure. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. You know, maybe advice to a manager is looking back. The obvious answer is time, right? If someone's been there 20 years, it's probably going to be considered a success. If the person was there a half a day, it was obviously a failure. But maybe some just additional thoughts from you on evaluating whether this hire now was a success or a failure.
That's a tough question. So it may be one of, I felt like I made a hiring failure in how they're performing early on. But again, it goes back to leadership. So let's say I hire somebody and they're now developing for Bear Analytics or developing for Zuhu, and I'm just not seeing the performance that I'm expecting. And so at this point, it's so early that there's not really a quote unquote performance issue where they were great and now they're not great, or, you know, they're not meeting standards or whatever your evaluation metric is. It's probably you hired the wrong person. They're out of their depth, and maybe you didn't do the right things to make sure you were hiring the right person in the first place. Again, going back to the leadership. And I made a lot of these mistakes early on because I took at face value as gospel what a lot of resumes said. So particularly for positions you're hiring for, which would be very pertinent to your listeners who are managers over crime analysis, over law enforcement analysts or intelligence analysts, chances are they probably don't know the job, at least to the extent the analyst knows it. So how do you hire analysts when you don't know the job and know what to measure them by? So if an analyst comes to you and you're a sort of a non-analyst manager and says, I know how to do ArcView and I know how to do Attack and I need how to do Excel. I'm a master ninja guru Yoda at Excel. Like, wow, master ninja Yoda guru. You guys are going to knock it out of the park. And you hire them based on their understanding of their skill set. And then your expectations, they don't quite meet up to those. Well, it goes back to you. Because just because they said they were really good at X, Y, and Z doesn't mean that you vetted that. So one of the things we started doing, and this also is applicable in law enforcement, we started testing our developers. And so we created a test that if a developer wanted to work for us, whether it be a Java developer, a React developer, a C++ developer, a Visual Basic developer, we had a test that they had to pass so that we could gauge their competency. Not only their competency, but how does their code look? How do they remark things? How does it flow? Have they just sort of hack into things? Or does it look like they understand structured coding language and so on? And we were able to, by having that test, weed out quite a lot of people that, one, didn't want to put forth that kind of effort to get the job. Well, if you're weeding out somebody that is willing to quit on the application process, you're probably dodging a bullet. You know, you're welcome. But the other was to weed out the people that maybe thought they were, in a genuine way, thought they were right for the job, But then after taking our test, realize, maybe I don't know all that I think I know or thought I knew. And so maybe they go somewhere else. And a lot of this is true in crime analysis, isn't it? We had a crime analysis test that we gave to all our incoming crime analysts to gauge whether or not we thought they met our standards before we even then trained them on additional things that we wanted to train them on. So, you know, as I said in previous podcasts, even to be an analyst way back in the day in 1992, I had to take a handwritten test to be an analyst and perform chi-square and I think correlation by hand to demonstrate my competency to do the job. And I had to practice chi-square because I wasn't good at it. So there's real value in having testing prior to getting hired. I mean, think of all the testing, the barrage of testing that police officers go through to get their job. Why would you not test your analysts? You need to be able to do that and hold them to a high standard, and you'll know what you're getting. So then there is no opportunity for failure right out of the gate with that, is there? Because they passed the test. They know the job. Now it's not about knowing the job and performing well. Now it's about, you know, just being successful in the job. That is your job too as a leader.
All right. Let's switch over to the employee now. And I guess, you know, let's talk about some advice to those that have either been laid off or fired. Now what?
Yeah. Sorry. One. So you wouldn't probably guess this about me, but I still have my CV or my resume. I call it a CV because it's overly long, but my CV I have updated almost weekly. I'm constantly making sure that my CV is up to date because you never know when the opportunity might present itself to share my CV with somebody to either get a job or to get on a board or to do whatever. So the first thing that I would say prior to hopefully not being laid off is right now, make sure your CV, your resume is ready to rock and roll this day. Because tomorrow, you never know what could happen. And the last thing you want to do, you know, you're in a routine. You might have worked for an agency for 5, 10 years, maybe even longer. You probably aren't spending a lot of time on the resume because, frankly, you're not looking for work, are you? But you're not taking the time to update it with presentations, with papers you've authored or co-authored, with books you've written, with new phone numbers and just new looks and feels of resumes, so on and so forth. So, you know, what do you do when you get laid off? Well, now that you've prepared, at least you have that resume. So again, I keep going back to before layoff, but it's important because the post layoff is less painful if you have these things in place. So what I was going to say is post layoff, begin to reach out to your network. Well, guess what? Pre-layoff, you need to be nurturing and creating a network of people you know, not necessarily just in your own little bubble, but outside your bubble too. You know, I have networking friends in media. I have them in nonprofits. I have them in other software companies that are in no way related to what we're doing right now. I'm always trying to meet new people and build a relationship or at least establish some sort of relationship with people because you never know when you have an opportunity to serve them, but you also never know if something were to happen that you might be able to put the word out and somebody be able to help you too. So it's very important for anybody at any stage in their career to have the resume ready to rock and roll as well as their network constantly nurtured and up to date. So now to answer your question directly, well, what do you do when you get laid off? Immediately put those two things into motion. You got your resume, you got your network, go get another job, assuming that's what you want to do. I would probably, depending upon where you came from, look for, you know, short-term gaps. You're probably concerned about healthcare. So you'll have to quickly learn about COBRA and how long your healthcare is, coverage lasts. You'll want to know those things. Those are probably the first couple days. You'll probably want to contact the state to find out about unemployment or other sorts of resources you have. Depending upon what sort of religious organization you may belong to, the one that I do is very good about having actually an employment specialist be in each of the different congregations, the wards. And so if I were to lost my job, one of my first calls would probably be to them because they're sort of in tune with and always aware of opportunities and people who can help. So I hope that helps.
I would say just to add to that, and this is a big meatball in itself, is just the emotions, right? There's going to be this rejection and that's a whole series of podcasts. We could go on that, just the feeling of rejection and trying to get over it. So there's going to be that time as well where you're just going to have to compartmentalize and deal with this feeling of rejection.
I like that you said that, because there again, maybe me knowing the resources that would be available to help you through that too. That's it's very astute of you to say that. There are resources, and even to be aware of, yeah, you might be having some depression or feeling of lack of worth. All those things are not true. Companies make decisions and departments make decisions all the time, sometimes right, sometimes wrong, hopefully in the best interest of the department at the end of the day. You're always going to land on your feet. Something I've always found, at least when I thought something tragic happened, or, you know, something big happened to where I thought a door was closed, you know, the statement of a window opens was always true for me too.
Is there anything in terms of being fired that you would add to that conversation? I mean, obviously, hopefully you learn from whatever you did.
Yeah.
And if there's something more problematic, you got fired because you're addicted to drugs or something like that, you obviously have to get that taken care of. Is there anything else that you want to add?
To just be respectful and oftentimes thank them for the opportunity to work there. Wish them well. Last thing you want to do is, you know, flame on and leave with your middle fingers up. And you know, that does nobody anything, and it only hurts you down the road. You never know who knows who and who's connected to who and who could open a door for you, but who could also potentially close a door for you, or maybe not open the door for you. Maybe that's a better way of saying that. So I've always found that no matter what happens, I always try and leave on a positive note and respectfully, knowing that hopefully they're making the decision in the best interest of the department. And if my performance was bad, you know what? That was theirs to determine. And again, they should be making that decision in the best interest of the department. And I'm moving on. Now, you know, there's a little sliver there too we need to sort of put in as an addendum to say, if you feel like you've been fired unlawfully or, you know, obviously you go down that path. Those usually aren't too frequent. Usually there's some reason.
And then for employees that are resigning, I mean, it should be pretty straightforward, but just something quickly to address in terms of do's and don'ts of resigning.
Well, same thing, right? I mean, it would be no different. You always be respectful. You always be thankful. So even though you're parting ways at this day, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, life was grand. You loved it here and they loved you. So there was a time when it was a mutually beneficial relationship. If it has to end now and you're resigning, even if the manager's a jerk, the boss is a jerk, the owner couldn't be a bigger idiot, the work sucks, whatever it is, you wanted to work here in the first place. So don't, you know, sort of bemoan that and don't belittle the fact that you're leaving there. So I would say leave on a very high note, thank them, very respectful, because you never know who's going to be calling that employer to say, you know, how were they as an employee, or how did they leave their employment? Did they resign gracefully, or did they, you know, walk out of there in an angry state? So it's usually helpful to resign respectfully.
The only thing I'll add to that is this would probably come up and it would probably not catch anybody off guard, but make sure you understand the resignation rules to your agency. I'm thinking specifically about Vanderbilt, because it's expected that you give 30 days notice.
Yeah.
And if you give less than that, you could never work for Vanderbilt again.
Yes, not eligible for rehire, which got to our previous conversations about when people call for references, or a reference is calling me to say, hey, what do you think of Jason? Should we hire him? Now, my attorneys have advised me as an employer not to answer that like, oh, they were a jerk, or oh, they were awesome, or anything. Mm-hmm. Just they're eligible for rehire or they're not eligible for rehire. Right. And so the Vanderbilt thing is very interesting. Yes, you should know that before you resign. Because again, you want to resign on a good note.
So we have one last section here, and this one really excites me because I think it is so overlooked. That is designating responsibility. This goes more in line with you have employees that have resigned. They're either the 2 weeks or 30 days or whatever time period they have left, managers need to designate the responsibility of this employee to other employees.
Yeah.
The reason I think it's so overlooked is there's so many times that I start working with somebody on a project and I start asking questions about the project. They'll not really know the why, they'll not really know the purpose. All they'll know is, well, I go into this spreadsheet, hit this button, and it produces this report, and I email it to that person over there. They weren't part of the original plan to put this project together. And I always refer to it as a bad game of telephone. Yeah. And, you know, for those that don't know what telephone is, that's a game where you sit in a circle, you have one person whisper to their neighbor a statement, and then you work your way around the room. Each person whispers into their neighbor's ear what they heard was until you get to the end and see how close it was to the original saying. This can be the same thing in the workplace, because you can have multiple generations of people handing down this project, handing down this task. And then at the end, all the person knows is, well, that's the way we've always done it. And I think there's so much room for improvement here from a manager's perspective on making sure that before the employee leaves, that he or she hand down as much knowledge as possible. And we talked a little bit about documentation in a previous episode, but this time is so crucial to handing the baton, the responsibilities from the exiting employee to the next employee.
It all comes down to policies and procedures, and you're absolutely right. And if the policies is usually dealt with on a managerial level or higher organizational level, but the procedures, that's all you, analyst. So chances are you developed the procedure. You're the one who said, this map will go out weekly and it will have this sort of data and reflect this sort of analysis. So you develop these things based on the user's need, your customer's need, excuse me, and you provide that product to them to satisfy their need. The manner in which you create it or the process that you use to create it should not be in your head. It needs to be put on paper somewhere. And that's what I see is a lot of the failings of the departments is when they lose somebody, as you just described, you know, they're scrambling and they're saying, well, how did they do this? And it's like, well, I don't know how they did it. It's now gone with them because it's in their head. So those sorts of things, these sort of regular products needs to be documented. And that was one of the big things that we did as an analyst in Tempe is constant documentation of our procedures. And that's one of the things that I saw a lot of agencies that we worked with would do is develop procedures for how to do things. So that, you know, if Billy got hit by the bus and Sally had to come in to be the analyst, she could easily do it because it says here, assuming Sally had the expertise to do it, but okay, we need to produce this. Here's the actual product. It's in the procedure. Now here are the steps used to recreate that product. And this product needs to go out every Tuesday. And here's the distribution list that gets it. That's pretty straightforward. On a daily basis, the data needs to be downloaded. You know, Frank had that in his big brain. No. That's not how we work around here. It's written down so that anybody within the unit could do that because it's the standard procedure we all follow to download the data. That's sort of already baked into the way law enforcement works. Not a lot of analysts may know this, but there's a procedure, a written procedure for how to handcuff somebody. You might think, what? You know, you're putting the handcuffs on them. How could you need to be explained that? And worse, why would you need to have it written down somewhere? Well, because of liability reasons and to make sure you do it right and to make sure they can't escape and to make sure you don't hurt them or you hurt yourself. So there was literally a written down procedure for how to properly handcuff somebody and then double lock the cuffs for security. So law enforcement already has all this. They already have a procedure for everything. And it's oftentimes for that reason. And it's also for continuity and consistency and standardization, right? So to do that in the analytical shop is a no-brainer. You need to do that too. And yeah, it's kind of a pain and it takes a little bit of time. Once it's created, just like your resume, to maintain it isn't that bad. If you now have to go back and you're scrambling 2 weeks before somebody says that they put in their 2 weeks and they're quitting, you're already almost screwed, truthfully. Mm-hmm. So you really should have been doing this all along. Again, like the resume. So I would say to those managers right now, if your unit can't hand you a procedures manual for the big things they do, I'm not talking about, you know, counting in Excel or something. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to like the products they produce. If they don't have a procedure in place, establish that right away and make sure everybody is sort of adhering to the same standard. Because as you know, in law enforcement, in law enforcement analysis, if two analysts are doing something two different ways, oftentimes they can get different results. So that's also mm-hmm. the same reason to sort of standardize things.
Yeah. And I would really encourage managers to take this more seriously, because I think it's a big problem to encourage that the last, you know, 2 weeks or 30 days of employment, really try to encourage the employee to help y'all out and get all those finalized. You're right. If they're just beginning now, it's a lost cause. But just to spend that time finalizing all those procedures, even if you have to add some kind of incentive to try to get that done, I think it would be worthwhile to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I guess for the I can't call them job seekers one last time, for the employee that's leaving, I just feel that when I left, there were some projects that I could tell were more important to me than others.
Yeah.
Especially there was databases that I created, tools that I developed that I really wanted to see go on. That's when I made sure that people that I was leaving behind really understood what I was doing. Because you want your projects to continue. I mean, maybe you don't. Maybe you really don't care at this point. I shouldn't assume, right? But I mean, look, you especially if you've been there a really long time. I mean, if you've been there decades and you've developed these projects, these reports, these tasks, these tools, you may want to consider making sure they get passed on to the next generation.
Not for self-serving reasons, only because the department mandates that they continue on. Steve Gottlieb said something way back in the day. I'm talking way back in the day, like 91 to me, that kind of stuck with me. And that is, you know, check in that your products are in fact being used and check in the garbage forum. I always love that he said that. But he's so true. And in fact, when I took over in Tempe, not took over, when I got the job in Tempe to be an analyst, one of the analysts that was there left. And I was sort of evaluating, asking the question, why are we doing this particular report? You know, prior to this individual leaving, she had told me, you know, you do this every week because we do this every week. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this every week. And then she left. And of course, me being the inquisitive person that I am, asked, why are we doing this every week? And, you know, just because she said so, it didn't mean anything to me. So I started asking the consumers of that product what they thought about it. Could we improve upon it? And they're like, what? Oh, no, we delete that, dude. We're not using that. This one individual was spending, I don't know, 4 hours a week producing this one report that literally nobody could care less about and used and just immediately threw in the garbage. I think with a new employee maybe taking over for somebody, there is nothing wrong with doing a little assessment to say, okay, how are we doing before I just arbitrarily start doing all of these reports that everybody is apparently needing? Do you still need it? Can I make it better? Is there other things we can do that could maybe improve upon it or tweak it or frequency and all these different sorts of things? But it's that evaluation of your products, good or bad, that are going to help you be the best analyst ever. So if I had produced something and I was then leaving and had the mindset of, you know what, you need to keep doing this, Bill, because I created this and it took me a lot of time to recreate this and it's a work of art and I'm proud of it. And, you know, look at this macro. You have to be a genius to write this macro. And I wrote this macro. And so it needs to keep going. Some people might do that, but it's not my thing to try and establish a legacy. It's like, look, what are the customers asking for? That's what's important. And so the very first thing that I would probably do as a new analyst is to have that assessment.
Just a final thought on what you said about Steve Gottlieb. He actually purposely did them on different colored paper. So
yeah, I like that. That was so good too. Yeah.
Could tell real quick when he looked in the garbage can whether his reports were in the garbage can.
And you know what that comes from? It comes from a, I don't say a business sense, because everybody can have a business sense, but it is that sort of self-evaluation that he had in that regard, where I am producing a good and service And I'm going to do my market analysis to determine how well it's doing. And you can borrow from other disciplines, just like in law enforcement. Back in the day, we borrowed from biology to do the animal tracking stuff that mm-hmm. was available through Esri's product. That was pretty cool stuff. But we were borrowing the techniques there. Law enforcement can borrow from the business community to understand how to evaluate whether or not a product has value and to continue doing it. And then also to use those little techniques that he did. And there are things that are available where if you're sending out an email, you know, to see whether or not people delete it or how they open it, you could have it maybe tied to a website, how long they now spend on the website. We here at Zuhu use a technique where when they're on our website, we track where their mouse cursor is, and you can sort of pseudo track where their eyes are based on how long they're spending in certain sections. Well, you could do that with your analytical products too. If you were to place them on the web and then release them to the department that way, you could see which sections of your product were most interesting and where they spent the most time, and others where they didn't, and they just sort of blew through it. So there's so many cool things that we can borrow from other disciplines or professions and apply them to law enforcement.
That brings us back to the search. We've gone through the guide entirely, all seven steps, and we've completed the cycle. And now you come out of the exit and you go back to the search and you start all over again. So I guess, Sean, any final words that you might have through this whole process?
Well, if I didn't say anything, I kind of sound like an idiot at the end here, wouldn't I? Because you're interviewing me for hiring. And I'm like, no, I don't have anything else. Did cover a lot of ground. So yes, I have some advice that I don't know that has come out in some of the previous podcasts or this one. I'm now a big proponent of mentor-mentee. I'm on now company number, you know, whatever. I've always found that if I thought I had the answer or I was too proud to go seek some advice or some help from somebody else, I usually ended up spending more time than I probably would have had I just asked somebody who knew the answer already. So what I would suggest for law enforcement analysts out there, managers too, is ask a lot of questions and maybe find some confidants or some mentors that you can look to and rely upon to give advice. Not that it's going to be the end all be all advice. You take advice for what it is, right? And then you maybe compare it against other advice. But I've found that the longer I've been in business, I'll say possibly correlated to success in business too, I found that when I'm actually reaching out and asking for help and advice and, hey, have you encountered this? Or, hey, I've got this situation, what would you do? I actually seek out mentors now that I am much more productive and able to get further faster than what I probably would have done way back in the day, which is I'm going to go find the answer myself. And I don't want to ask because I'm too embarrassed to ask. I'll also drive home the point of how important networking is, not only in law enforcement, but in life. More and more, as we're now starting to remote work and other things, even more so, our personal lives are melding into and meshing in with our business lives. And I've seen that more and more, particularly in my life. And I would just suggest to people that they continue to build out their network. And if they haven't done it at all, please begin to build out your network. Get on LinkedIn, great solution, you know, for people there. I'm always on it. I'd shared with you in a previous podcast that I had sought out, in addition to poaching analysts from you, Jason, I had also sought out analysts who were interns in other departments. Don't discount the fact that your LinkedIn profile may lead to opportunity. And there's three or four analysts, maybe even a little bit more, that can attest to that, who were in fact poached from LinkedIn because of what they had on LinkedIn. I'm constantly looking for developers on LinkedIn. That's one example. But analysts too, you'll be poached if you have your stuff out there. But then also, and I know the IACA offers this, but also LinkedIn offers this too. If you've got some experience, if you've been in the business 5-10 years or more, make yourself available for others to learn from. There's nothing worse than somebody who walks a path, who experiences a slippery rock that continues on the path without turning back and moving that slippery rock so that somebody else who's on that path doesn't slip on it. And so I've always liked that. That comes from a book called The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. And that metaphor has always stuck in my head, that as you walk your path, if you have a stumble, you know, don't look back and think, well, somebody else has got to experience that like I did. No, move the rock for them. So we do that by offering up our mentoring services. I always am reaching out to others, maybe who have started a business, whether they like it or not. I'll offer my services and say, hey, look, I was where you were at. I'm more than happy to help you know about social media or know about setting up a business or an LLC or all those sort of good things that come with growing a business. So I'm always trying to help and insert myself into helping. So those are some bits of advice I would give. I'll shamelessly plug Circles. Circles is the app we present. And I only plug that because I use it to maintain my network. And so I'm constantly making sure that I'm reaching out to people and nurturing relationships and things like that, because opportunities present themselves. Jason, you reached out to me because we're in the same network together. We've known each other for a long, long time. And I'm more than happy to help with your endeavor here. But it's about networking and relationships. Remember, 3 in 4 people get their first job because of somebody they knew. It wasn't because of the grades they got. It wasn't because of their ACT scores or the internship they did necessarily. It's because of who they knew. So no more people, right? Build out your who's. The more people you know, the more opportunity you have. 75% of people get their first job by somebody they knew.
Just to add to that, the two bits of advice I have, particularly for young people, is to read up on and study leadership until you've found your own philosophy. So when I mentor, I always suggest 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. There's a ton of classic leadership books out there to choose from. The second one is for young people is to learn about personal finance. Again, it's a kind of the same idea. There's a ton of books. Some people like Dave Ramsey, some people don't, but find somebody that you can listen to or that you can read and understand until you find your way.
I love that. So. And let me, if I may, since we're mentioning books on that, and I'm glad you said Covey and Ramsey. I read a book way back in the day called A Millionaire Mind by Harv Eker. Finances is oftentimes a matter of mindset. To tie it into this podcast, we talked earlier about when people go to ask for raises, oftentimes they asked for the raise because their finances warranted it, because they needed more money to do the things they want to do. And, you know, that aside, a book like T. Harv Eker's, which A Millionaire Mind, will give you sort of a perspective on money and how it can be good and how it can cause problems for you, but how to have the right mindset about money. I think that would be one book that I've read that has been impactful for me.
Thank you, Sean, for going on this journey with me. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate your time helping me put this together. I hope the listeners, there's several gems that you get out of this, and there's ways that you can improve your own life, things to think about and to help you grow. Sean, I'll give you the last word. Do you have any just final thoughts?
Well, that's why we did this, isn't it? It's to move those slippery rocks for people so they don't trip on them, so they walk an easier path than we have. So I hope in that regard, these podcasts will help with that journey. And I wish everybody well on their journey. As always, I'm available to anybody who has a question, who would like mentorship or to ask about either business or law enforcement or anything. I'm available. Hit me up on LinkedIn or Sean@Zuhu.com. Sean spelled S-E-A-N, Zuhu, Z-O-O-W-H-O, like who's who in your zoo.
And if you want to get a hold of me, it's leapodcasts@gmail.com. leapodcasts@gmail.com. So thank you everyone for listening. You take care and be safe.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcasts.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.